May it please the court, I'm David Hanza on behalf of the appellant Sound Exchange. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This morning, I'd wanted to focus on just two of the issues that we raised in our briefs. First, the rates that were set by the copyright royalty judges for 2010 through 2012 were unsupported by and indeed contrary to the evidence in the record. And second, the copyright royalty judges erred in setting a rate that was calculated as a function of substantially all of the revenues of the satellite services, but then got applied to a significantly smaller subset of those revenues, resulting in a lower effective rate that the evidence did not justify. Now, on the first issue, the court found that a royalty rate of close to 13% of gross revenues would be reasonable under the statute, but for the perceived need to adjust that number downward so as not to jeopardize the service's ability to meet target dates for becoming EBITDA positive or constrain their ability to launch new satellites. Now, in order to accomplish—
Are you saying anything below 13% would be arbitrary and capricious?
I think in order to set something below that and avoid being arbitrary and capricious, the evidence would have had to support the two reasons the court gave for setting a lower rate, and for these years of 2010 through 2012, it does not.
So on this record, trying to get the answer to my question, on this record, it would be arbitrary and capricious to have anything below 13%?
Yes, Your Honor. For those years that I'm talking about, yes. There are other errors that I want to talk about as well, but I would say that yes is the answer. What the court said was that it was departing from the 13% that it otherwise found to be reasonable so that the satellite services could become EBITDA positive on the time they projected that they would, and so they could launch new satellites. There are a number of issues relating to that decision to adjust downward, but again, for those years, it simply is not supported by the evidence. All of the evidence showed that the satellite services could pay much more in 2010, 2011, 2012, and still be EBITDA positive, and still launch whatever satellites they needed to launch. And let me start with EBITDA. The services' target date for becoming EBITDA positive was 2009. The court said it didn't want to delay that. And the court said that analysis by a Sound Exchange expert, Mr. Butson, showed that an average rate over the entire term of the license would delay the achievement of positive EBITDA. That fundamentally mischaracterizes the testimony and the evidence submitted by Mr. Butson. And in particular, if you look at what the court cited, which is Appendix E to Mr. Butson's testimony, it's in the record at 853 and 854. Okay. The court cited it. The court relied on it. What Mr. Butson did there was he projected out revenues and costs through 2012, and then he did a sensitivity analysis where he showed what the effect of different royalty levels would be on EBITDA and other economic metrics. If you look, you'll see that what he shows is that for 2009, the target date when the services were supposed to become positive on EBITDA, the rate set by the court, 6.5%, produces that result. But for 2010, what he shows is the services will still be EBITDA positive, and indeed even more so, at a royalty rate of 12%. So substantially higher than what the board set. For 2011, at a rate of 14%, when the board, I think, at that point was at 7.5, at 14%, the services would still be EBITDA positive, and indeed, again, even more so than the prior year. 2012, again, at a rate of 17%, the services would be EBITDA positive, again, at a level even higher than the prior year. And at that point, the court's rate was 8%. So at more than double the rate that the court set, the services would still be EBITDA positive. And indeed, I think it's worth keeping in mind that 17% is even higher than the 13% that the court found reasonable. The point is you could go to that 13% and still achieve the goal that the court said it was trying to achieve of making these companies EBITDA positive. And it's not just the evidence from Sound Exchange's Mr. Butson that shows that, because the services in their rebuttal cases also submitted projections through 2012, which showed their revenues and their costs and so on. And you can do the math on those exhibits and get to precisely the same result. Those projections used a royalty rate, I think, of 4.2% was what they were assuming. But it's very easy to just look at their numbers, look at the revenue number, do the math, and what you find is it's consistent with Mr. Butson. 2011, 2012, 2010, you could have far higher percentages, 12%, 14%, 17%, still be EBITDA positive. Now, we don't agree that somehow achieving positive EBITDA on the timetable that the services established for themselves was necessarily a valid basis under the statute to reduce the rate from the 13% that the court found otherwise justified. But the point for this morning is, even if that was a valid basis, the evidence simply didn't support it in those years. Now, the other rationale for the court in reducing from the 13% that it said was reasonable was so that the services could fund new satellites. Now, to begin with, only Sirius actually said it needed to do so. XM said that it planned one new satellite and it was already building it, and the documents in the record showed actually that their capital expenditures were projected to go substantially down. They actually submitted an exhibit, I believe it was Vendetti Exhibit 14, which showed their capital expenditures dropping substantially from 2006 through 2010. So this was really only an issue relevant to Sirius. Sirius claimed that it needed to replace all of its satellites in 2012. But no one ever put any evidence in the record which showed any particular level of royalty that would affect the ability to fund and build those satellites. In fact, the only evidence in the record, I believe, was, again, evidence from Mr. Butson, who did projections specific to Sirius. That was his Appendix A. It's in the record at 823 to 826. And Mr. Butson shows capital expenditure numbers that would fund the new satellites for Sirius in 2012, and he shows that those capital expenditures could be funded out of their working capital and their income. Now, that was a conservative assumption on his part, because in fact, the satellites are a capital asset with a 15-year life, so one wouldn't ordinarily just pay for them out of cash. But nevertheless, his evidence showed that one could do that. So the notion that a less than 13% royalty was necessary for replacement satellites is a complete red herring for XM and is at best unsupported by the record for Sirius and really is contradicted by the evidence submitted by Mr. Butson and not controverted by anyone else. In short, the downward departure for 2010, 11, and 12 is entirely unsupported by the evidentiary record in this case. Instead of taking the evidence that the court had to calculate what the services could pay and still be EBITDA positive in those years and still fund satellites in those years, the court simply took its 2007-2008 rate and just arbitrarily ramped it up by 0.5% per year. And I think you will search the record in vain for any explanation of where those numbers come from or any evidence to justify those numbers.
That's always going to be the case once you are off the market-based rates, though, right?
I realize
that's part of your point, but...
It is part of the point, but I don't think it's also necessarily the case. If there were conflicting evidence, for example, the court, of course, could credit some and not others, but that's not what happened here. The court might do a calculation differently, and actually that happened. The 13%, I should emphasize, was not Sound Exchange's rate proposal. Sound Exchange's rate proposal was higher. But what the court did was it credited the testimony of one of Sound Exchange's economic experts. But then it said, we agree with this part of his testimony, we don't agree with that part of his testimony, and the result of that was that they came down to 13%. So it is certainly possible to come up with a different number, but it's got to be supported by the evidence, which this isn't, and there's got to be an explanation for how they got there, and there isn't one in this record. I think the second issue that I'd wanted to address relates to all of the years of the rate period, and that is that the court found that a rate starting at 6% and escalating to 8% was appropriate for the entire rate period, and it calculated that rate as a function of substantially all of the services revenues. But then when it applied that rate, or allowed the satellite services to apply it when they actually calculate their payments, it allowed them to apply that to substantially less than all of their revenues.
Of course, they said exactly the opposite. They said it doesn't affect, there isn't a substantial difference here.
There is.
With respect at least to the use of music.
There is a substantial difference.
And why is that?
There are two. Number one of the things that's omitted from the revenues that the satellite services calculate their royalty on is advertising revenue. Right? What the court said was, we're going to include advertising revenue only to the extent that it's on principally music stations. We're going to exclude it to the extent that it's not on music stations. Well, the problem is, all of the music stations, with a very few exceptions, are commercial free, as the court well knew. I think there were 140 music stations on XM and Sirius, 135 are commercial free. So if you exclude advertising unrelated to music, you're excluding all of the advertising.
And you're including it for five stations.
Yes.
Whatever. You're excluding it for stations that, for instance, are talk radio.
Yes.
And don't use music to any measurable degree.
Right. And
so that seems appropriate, doesn't it?
It would. We are not saying that the definition of revenue necessarily had to include all revenues, that satellite services have. What we're saying is you can't calculate the amount of the royalty based on total revenues and then apply it to less. Now, the problem is there's just a mismatch between how the court set the rate and what it gets applied to. That's the fundamental problem. And coming back to the advertising revenues, it's a big number. I think the services and the government have tried to downplay it, but in both Butson and the services' own evidence, we're talking about over $1 billion.
The difference between
would be the difference in the revenue base that
the revenue base would. and how much revenue?
The amount of additional revenue the amount of revenue that's being excluded from the calculation here is over $1 billion.
Over how many years?
Over the term of the license, which goes through 2012.
So 6 years.
Yes, right. But there's a second thing that potentially gets excluded here that is actually very, very significant. And that is that the court, when it defined the revenue that this is going to be
applied to. It doesn't include equipment.
I'm sorry?
That doesn't include equipment then.
No, I'm not including equipment in that number.
Okay. So you're saying 6 or 8% or whatever of the $1 billion.
More than $1 billion, we believe, yes, which is, for me, real money.
Not anymore.
Not for the federal government, but it is for the copyright owners. But the other thing, and I want to make sure we focus on this, the court also allowed the services to start charging separately for non-music channels and then not include that revenue in the calculation as well. And again, to be clear, we're not saying that you couldn't ever have a revenue definition like that, but where you've calculated the rate based on all subscribers, and then you apply it to something less than all subscribers, you are giving a discount that was never intended.
Well, when you say never intended, are you saying they didn't know what they were doing?
I can't.
In which case, we would forgive them.
I don't know whether the court appreciated the significance of what would happen as a result of that. I simply have no way to know. But the fact of the matter is, the satellite services are now doing exactly, they're walking through the door that the court opened for them, and they're selling some non-music channels separately, so now that they presumably don't include that revenue in the calculation. And again, under other circumstances, maybe it would be appropriate to define revenue that way, but not where you originally set the rate based on all subscriber revenue.
So what, and what is the, over the six-year life, what is the estimated subscriber revenue?
The subscriber revenue that's being excluded?
No, included.
I don't have that number at the top of my head, Your Honor. I'll be happy to figure it out.
Tell us on rebuttal.
Yes.
If you can,
thank you.
Just estimate it. Okay, thank you.
I think I've got 28 seconds left for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Sarang Damlai for the Librarian of Congress. So to take the last question first from Judge Ginsburg, as we point out in our brief, subscription revenues form the vast majority, 90% plus, of the revenues of these services. And so what SoundExchange is talking about is a relatively small portion of advertising revenues, and furthermore, it's an unknown portion of advertising revenues. They've never, and the judges explained all of this on rehearing. The judges never, the SoundExchange never explained exactly how much, what the differences were between the advertising revenues as the judges had defined it, the revenue definition that the judges had adopted, and total advertising revenues. Mm-hmm. It's unclear. The judge's definition includes, moreover, all advertising revenues except to the extent they're used on channels that only make incidental use of sound recordings.
So the $1 billion figure was never put
before. The $1 billion figure assumes that all advertising revenues of these companies are excluded, which is just not true.
But today what we heard and in the brief is that $1 billion was excluded from the calculation of total advertising revenues, didn't we?
No, I believe he's saying that the total amount of revenues, the total amount of advertising revenues over the license term is $1 billion. And assuming that somehow that they're entitled to those revenues, that's the difference that they're getting. But the judges, or the copyright royalty judges included some portion of those advertising revenues, and SoundExchange has never explained exactly how much advertising revenues were included in the judge's definition. Their entire brief is based on the assumption that all advertising revenues are excluded from the revenue base. In any event, we're talking about relatively small amount in comparison to the subscription revenues. The judges discussed this again, and also in the rehearing order. Subscription revenues are the whole ball game, essentially, and I think everyone understood that before the agency. In terms of I think there was really no inconsistency, sort of internal inconsistency in the judge's reasoning. I don't think there's any indication, Judge Kavanaugh, that the judges were confused about the different revenue bases. They understood very well that the various parties were proposing slightly different revenue bases. They have a whole section of their opinion which they sort of address the revenue definition and what the appropriate revenue definition should be. I think the judges were very aware that the various parties' proposals, the percentages that they were proposing, were based on different revenue bases. And so I don't think there's any sense in which the judges had any misapprehension about what the parties were proposing. So to go back to the first issue, whether the rates in the later years of the term were unsupported, the judge's interpretation of SoundExchange's expert model was that an 8% average rate over the license term. So that's taking the percentages in each year and averaging it over the number of years in the term, that an 8% average rate over the license term would be disruptive to the services. And at least in their brief, Sound Exchange never disputed that interpretation, the judge's interpretation of their expert's model. And if you look at the judge's schedule, the starting at 6% and ending at 8% in 2012, and you average that, you end up with 6.83%, which is below what they thought the disruptive average rate would be. And I think it's a matter of simple math to show that the judges interpreted it's below the sort of cutoff that the judges found as being the sort of line between what would be disruptive and what wouldn't be disruptive. I think it's a matter of simple math to show that if you, as Sound Exchange suggests, if the judges were to have instead started with a 6% rate and increased it to a 13% rate by the end of the term, that the average rate over that term would be somewhat greater than 8%, and under the judge's interpretation of Sean Butson's model would have been disruptive. So I think the judge's decision on that score was entirely consistent. Furthermore, the judges relied not only on the expert model provided by Sound Exchange, they relied on the testimony, they cited the testimony of the CFOs of the services, David Freer and Mark Vendetti, and cited their testimony that they had that 4.2% in their view, 4.2% of revenues would be disruptive to the services. And so the judges were looking at all of these different things, and they came up with the schedule which they did, which we think is entirely consistent with their view of the record, which they were entitled to make. I don't know if you have any further questions. I don't know if I have anything.
Just on a side issue, the judges, as you refer to them, are an executive agency, right?
It's a matter that hasn't been addressed in this
case. That's the position, right?
That is the position. It was argued 5 days ago.
Aren't they principal
capably
officers?
By my colleague.
Aren't they principal officers?
Our view is that they're not. Again, Your Honor, this has not been briefed, and in fact, Sound Exchange was supporting the constitutionality
they
of.
They sure look like principal officers.
Well, to the extent that you have any concerns about the constitutional issues in this case, I think the appropriate course would be to wait for the decision of the panel who heard those issues only 5 days ago.
Well, Mr. Danley, it may be because of the uncertainty surrounding that issue, maybe not, but it is difficult for me to get a handle on the varieties of relief being requested here. What have you suggested? Have you suggested a remand?
We've suggested a limited.
I'm talking about Section 112.
No, Section 112. Yeah, we've suggested that the more prudent course, perhaps, and the course more consistent with the Register's determination. The Register found that
the
judges should have had more.
One of the odd things about this, I don't know what to make of the status of the Register. Statute says whatever the Register says doesn't affect our standard of review, right?
I think the best way to interpret that provision, I believe that's 802 F1E, the best way to interpret that is that if there's a difference of opinion on an issue of copyright law, as between the copyright royalty judges and the Register, that shouldn't affect this court's any deference that this court gives to the Register's ultimate determination, which is no different than when you have a
What is the Register's ultimate determination?
The Register's ultimate determination is the correction that she issued, which we believe is the only, which is the part of the, as to that issue, is the agency's final determination. And so.
So you think the Register's order is what's under review here?
As to that 112 issue, that's what's controlling, which is why we've asked for a remand to the agency.
It's not part of the order that was brought up by the petition.
The statute specifically says that the Register's decision shall correct the judge's determination, and it is included as part of the record before this court. And so we think that the statute means that the Register's determination is the one that controls on appeal. And
so if we denied the petitions, the Register's directive would take hold. And the board, the judges, the CRJ would have to respond to it.
If you were to deny, well, we think the appropriate course here is to remand the case.
I shouldn't say petition. If we were to affirm the judgment of the district court, what would happen?
It's somewhat difficult. I think
it is. I know.
I think the appropriate course is to send this case back. There's no one here is asking you to affirm the judge's determination in full.
The CRJ's.
The CRJ's determination in full. We're asking the registers the register determined that there was a material there was an error of material substantive copyright law, and that. According to the register, the judges should have found more facts to try to attempt to set a particular rate for the 112 license, and that.
Okay, so
in light
of
that error,
if we make no reference whatsoever to Section 112, what happens? We just affirm the judgment below.
If you were to not remand the matter. What would happen? The register's decision, we believe, would control, and there would have. I mean, it's difficult to know what happens at that point.
Well, if it controls, what does it control? It controls the CRJ, right?
It controls the CRJ.
So they would have to go and deal with Section 112.
Without a remand, I think that might be somewhat difficult for them to do. But I think that might be an option that was available to them, given how this issue has come up.
See, I'm not sure that there's a case or controversy with regard to Section 112. That's what I'm concerned about. Sound Exchange wants 8.8% of the revenues allocated to certain of its constituents.
Right.
It's free to do that, isn't it?
I think Sound Exchange can address exactly why that might not be so, but... I think it would be...
Well, you're indifferent, aren't
you? The 114 rate... Sound Exchange, you know, this statutory license doesn't only control Sound Exchange's relationship with its members. Sound Exchange also is a collective for all copyright owners, including copyright owners that aren't necessarily members of Sound Exchange. And so Sound Exchange, as to them, non-members of Sound Exchange are people that don't have necessarily a contractual relationship with Sound Exchange. So as to members, there might be some sort of way they can work around it. But as to the non-members of Sound Exchange, who Sound Exchange does not have that sort of contractual relationship with,
they
still have to know how to allocate the...
Are they the chosen by statute to play this role for non-members?
That's exactly right. Under the judge's determination, Sound Exchange is a designated collective for collecting royalty payments.
Not by the statute, but because of the judges?
Well, the statute requires the judges or authorizes the judges to pick a collective. It's okay. One of the issues also in webcasting.
So why does anybody bother with a contractual relationship?
Well, you can ask Sound Exchange why, you know,
the mysteries get more and more mysterious.
One more mystery. Can the register change the percentage from 6% to 8% and say, no, I think it should be 9%, 10%?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the register can only correct determinations of substantive copyright law. I believe that changing the percentage might bleed into issues of fact, which the register can't.
How about the Librarian of Congress?
No, I believe not, Your Honor.
That's why they sound like principal officers.
Again, that's not an issue that anyone has briefed in this case, and I think you know it's been fully argued in the case argued last week.
It was a little different track than what I was asking about, but anyway.
I go back to you for a moment to your statement that you think the register's decision controls, right? Controls the CRJ.
As to the 112 issue.
Yeah. But the statute provides that the register may intervene here, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
As a party, which would seem peculiar in the least.
It's a somewhat peculiar statute in many respects, Your Honor, but we think the best reading of the statute is that in speaking of the register's determination as correcting the judge's determination, that the best reading is that it corrects it, that it's what controls. And it'd be somewhat difficult, I think, for the register to have said that there was an error of law in the judge's determination, and for us to stand here and say that there was not. I think it's really the only sensible way to read the statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Bruce Rich, appearing on behalf of intervener SiriusXM. I'd like to address the initial subject raised by Mr. Hanzo, which was the assertion that the Court, absent its analysis of disruption, found that the reasonable rate was 13% non-questioning by Judge Kavanaugh. Mr. Hanzo suggested that it would have been an abuse of discretion for them to select any other rate. I think that's a material distortion of what the judges actually did. At JA 58 and on succeeding pages of the determination, the Court said, among other things, the following, quote, "No single market benchmark offered in evidence wholly satisfies the requisite analysis. Quote, some evidence offered by both parties can serve to identify the parameters of a reasonable range of rates within which a rate most reflective of the four 801B1 factors can be located. And similarly, quote, the marketplace evidence offered by the S-Stars and Sound Exchange support the determination of the parameters of a zone of reasonableness." Consistent with this Court's prior precedents with which the Court is familiar, what the Court did was establish a zone of reasonableness bounded on the lower end by 2.35%, which was the musical works rate, which it said the rate could not go as low as, but explicitly did not say fell outside of the zone. It bounded the zone on the bottom and expressly indicated that the 13% advocated by one of Sound Exchange's experts, Dr. Ordover, was the upper range of reasonableness. When you look at the math of the determination, taking all of the factors into account, Court came very close to about midway in between. The average rate over the period is 6.8%, squarely within the zone. And all of this Court's precedents indicate that so long as there is substantial evidence in the record that supports a result within that zone of reasonableness, which this result clearly falls within, it seems to us there can be no question but that that rate should stand.
So that I think Mr. Hanzo was challenging the way in which the CRJ determined the lower bound. Isn't that right?
Well, he was suggesting that because the Court indicated that the rate could not be as low as the musical works rate of 2.35%, it somehow follows that the only reasonable rate established by the Court must be the upper boundary rate of 13%. We don't think that's supported at all by the language or the analysis of the...
The CRJ determined that disruption would set in at some lower point.
Yes, that's right? Correct.
And he's challenging that calculation.
Well, there, Your Honor, the record evidence is again, extremely plentiful. You had the testimony of the chief financial officers of both companies who indicated on direct and on cross-examination and who appeared twice in the proceeding, not simply on direct but in rebuttal, who indicated that as you inch up from about 4 or 4.2% on up into the 5 and 6% range, risks to planning ability of the companies, risks to of being able as early as 2009 in a tightening credit market to go into those markets to refinance debt obligations coming due, hundreds of millions of dollars coming due during 2009, would place the company's operations in jeopardy. It was appropriate for the judges to evaluate and, as they did, credit that testimony. When they worked through the same exhibit that Mr. Hanzo pointed Your Honors to, which was Mr. Butson, Appendix E, you can readily see that as you move even in Mr. Butson's analysis from so-called Scenario 1 or Model 1 to Model 2, Model 1 being a flat 4% projected and Model 2 escalating up past 8%, which got the judges uncomfortable on average, you see that things like free cash flow for Sirius is pushed out a full year in the model. And that comported with testimony from Mr. Karmazin, the CEO, and others, that that kind of delay in the ability to demonstrate to potential funders and refinancing vehicles that you have the prospect of significant financial wherewithal, that kind of delay, there was simply enormous testimony to, and the judges clearly took all of that into account in saying, we're going to find something that doesn't push right up against the very last dollar of extraction from these companies that's going to threaten their ability to stand up and be viable, which is part of the policy determinants underlying the very statutory framework here under 801, the disruption factor itself. It was absolutely critical. Bear in mind, the fees that the court awarded were a full trebling of the prior arm's length fees agreed to between the parties, which were at or about 2 or perhaps 2.5%. So Sound Exchange will realize $1.5 billion estimated over this time period. And the argument that they wanted more, while understandable from their perspective, is scarcely a basis to argue the unreasonableness of the court's decision that the request for, in their case, 8 to 23%, or now on appeal 13%, simply pushed the envelope of risk in terms of the ability of these enterprises to function, to go into the capital markets, to refinance debt, to fund satellite obligations. And here Mr. Hanzo is incorrect in suggesting that XM didn't have comparable obligations with respect to a satellite investment and repeater investment. That's in our briefing, and we have the record sites. Very much imminent needs for these companies. That was classically predictive judgment making by the judges, who had a range from low to high. They picked pretty much squarely in the middle and supported very carefully their determinations not to risk upsetting the viability of this very still fragile enterprise, which has never had positive free cash flow, never had any positive net income, prospects of it even in the outer years, hugely speculative. And even Mr. Butson admitted how speculative it is to gauge 2010, 2011, 2012, no question about it. In that circumstance, the suggestion that the only rate that was appropriate was 13%, let alone that it would have satisfied the disruption factor, I think finds no basis in the record. I know I've extended beyond my time limits.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me first answer the court's question, which was, I think, doing some quick math, the total revenues over the license period appear to be about $21 billion. And that comes from JA 823 and the pages after that. Okay. With respect to Mr. Rich's point that there's this range that was reasonable from 2.5% to 13%, I think that's completely contrary to what the court said. Mr. Rich gets that bottom end from the musical works rate, and the court just flatly rejected that. They said it, quote, fails to provide a reasonable benchmark, unquote. They said, quote, substantial empirical evidence shows that sound recording rights are paid multiple times the amounts paid for musical works right in most digital markets, unquote. And they called the musical works benchmark, quote, severely flawed, unquote. So there's just no way on that decision one can say the court found a range of 2.5% to 13, and since we're somewhere in the middle, that's okay. In fact, the court only said one number in terms of what it found reasonable before it adjusted downward, as I described earlier, and that one number was 13%. Now, the government and the services try and justify that adjustment downward, first of all, by saying if you averaged out all of Mr. Butson's numbers, it might come out to something of an average of 8%. But the problem is what the record in this case showed was that the financial condition of the satellite services was going to improve dramatically over the rate term, and so that a rate which arguably would be reasonable in 2007 was going to be way too low in 2012. And so it isn't a rational way to do this, to just say let's take the average, because all of the evidence was going to be that they changed.
They bumped it up. Yeah.
The rate scaled from 6 to what? What's the max?
6 to 8 is what the court said.
So there's a 33% increase over time here, over the six-year period.
I will agree with the math, but I think if you're trying to tie that to the evidence and you're trying to do what the court said it was trying to do, which is make sure they became EBITDA positive and were able to fund satellites, what you see is that that's way lower. I mean, less than half in 2012. The rate that would still allow them to be EBITDA positive substantially, hundreds of millions of dollars, and allow them to fund satellites. So just taking the court's rationale for what it was trying to do, it set the rate way too low in those later years. And nothing in the testimony of Mr. Freer and Vendetti contradicts what I've been arguing. The court cited Mr. Freer. The only thing he said is, well, in our internal projections, we like the budget for 4%. He didn't say anything at all in that testimony about how that 4% would affect their operations, EBITDA, launching satellites in any year, much less in later years. And all Mr. Vendetti said was this, the most vague statement possible about essentially, well, you know, I'd be more comfortable with 6% than I would be with 8%. But that has to be contrasted with Mr. Vendetti's own numbers, which he submitted in his rebuttal testimony and which we cited in our reply brief, which show that if you do the math at 12%, 14%, 17% in 2010, 2011, 2012, still substantially EBITDA positive, still plenty of money to fund those satellites. So their own evidence proves that that rate was set too low.
So suppose the judges in 2010 concluded that they had miscalculated. Is there a mechanism in this statute? I guess I should have asked the government this, but a mechanism in this statute for them to correct mid-course?
No. In fact, I think that issue actually came up in a prior case, and the Court of Appeal said, no, you can't just come back and redo it. Now, one of the things the
petition to reopen.
No, there's no petition to reopen. So, you know, unfortunately, we'd love to come back and say, hey, look at what they're doing now. We just listened to their earnings call, but we're not in a position to do that.
So you can't recall their bonuses if they...
No, I cannot. Okay. Just one last point. The government said that the advertising revenue is small and unknown. It was neither. It's over $1 billion. I don't consider that small, nor was it unknown.
No, but I said the advertising revenue that was excluded by the CRJ and that you wanted put back in was the small and unknown.
Well, let's put it this way. The only advertising revenue that would have been included was on these five stations.
And the only that was excluded was what, on the ephemeral
users? The satellite services have a number of non-music content.
Incidental, I meant not ephemeral.
Right. Yeah. So it's that advertising. That's where they sell most of their advertising. And that's all the testimony was. They're mostly selling their advertising on Howard Stern, on NFL.
Howard Stern doesn't use music, right, or not much?
I think he does use some. But, again, this comes back to the point
I want to get this clear. There are certain stations that are mostly – that are basically talk that the judges said use music only incidentally. That's not in dispute, right? That's what we're talking about,
right.
Those stations.
Right.
Okay, so that's where a lot of the advertising revenue is.
That's right.
But that's where very little of the music is.
Right.
So what you don't have much of a claim to that advertising revenue if it's not generated by using music.
And if the court had calculated the percentage royalty that it was going to apply based on that more limited set of revenues, I wouldn't be here arguing this issue. You would have come up with a higher percentage. Okay. The problem I have is that when the court said 6% in 2007, it calculated that 6% against all of the revenues, including advertising. So it says 6% is the right number as a function of total revenues. But then it allows the SDARS to apply that percentage to a lower revenue base. So in effect, the effective royalty is lower than what the court said was appropriate. That's the problem. I'm not up here saying
and it's lower because the advertising on the mostly talk stations is not being taken into account.
To the tune of about $1 billion, and in addition.
And of course, if they were to reconsider that, they would say, well, okay, we should have said 6% on just the stations that use music more than incidentally.
Well, right? I think if they had reconsidered it, what they would have had to do is look at, if we think we need to look at when they're going to be EBITDA positive, taking as a percentage of less than all of the revenues. In other words, I think they would have had on this record to adjust the percentage up from 6% based on the evidence that they were using.
I see. Okay. All right. Further questions? Thank you, Mr.
Hanzo.
Mr. Damley, thank you. Thank you. All cases submitted.